the trial of Karen Reed for the death of her boyfriend, John O'Keefe, is underway.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
The first week of testimony has come to an end.
It's a spectacle. That's for sure.
We really heard the defense highlight some of the discrepancies between what was documented and what first responders said they remembered.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
The fact that the investigation wasn't thorough provides a big wrinkle in the prosecution's case.
They're supposed to be creating this reasonable doubt, and they're doing exactly that.
Everybody wants to know, us included, why he wouldn't go inside that home on the night that the body was discovered.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
It's always the theories or stories that each side will put forth, right, for a jury to listen to and decide which one is more believable.
We asked Karen Reed about that alleged confession.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him? I hit him.
I did not.
When the FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder, that never, ever happens.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
Defense attorneys learn in school, first class, the most important thing you can do is identify and select stupid juries.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
Karen Reed is facing up to life in prison.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
The trial of Karen Reed is moving along, and we have a lot to cover. In the last episode, we left off with Brian and Nicole Albert's testimony. In this episode, I want to cover the rest of the witnesses who were at Fairview that night who have testified, putting all of their information together to get a clearer picture. A lot of the testimony is very repetitive, so I don't want to get bogged down going through everything again. We are having to hear the same repetitive questioning in court with every single witness about if it was snowing, and if there was a band playing at Waterfall, and if the music was loud, and who was drinking what kind of beer or seltzer. By this point, you probably know the basic timeline of what happened that night, and if not, you can refer back to the previous episodes. Let's start with the birthday boy, Brian Albert Jr. He had invited some of his friends over to hang out and wasn't really feeling like going out to the Waterfall. Julie Nagel's dad drove her and Sarah Levinson to Brian Jr.'s and dropped them off to celebrate with Brian Jr. for his birthday, which would be official at midnight on the 29th. When the girls first got there, Brian Jr.'s mom, Nicole Albert, his sister, Caitlin Albert, and his aunt, Julie Albert, were also at the house, but they left for Waterfall about 15 to 25 minutes later. Four other friends joined the birthday celebration sometime between 8 to 9 p.m. They had calzones from D&E Pizza, were drinking Spike seltzers, and playing music on a Bluetooth speaker. Tristan Morris, Caitlin's boyfriend, drove from Easton to Waterfall to meet Caitlin, her mom, and her aunt. He had dinner and a couple of drinks, but he left early to get some rest since he was going to be plowing early that morning. Eventually, the rest of the group that we've heard testimony from all came to the Waterfall to meet up. We've heard from Matt and Jen McCabe that everything at Waterfall was overall how everyone else has said. Good vibes, no issues, nobody seemed overly intoxicated. Colin Albert had been at his friend Mike's house drinking before getting dropped off at Brian Jr.'s for his birthday. Brian Jr. doesn't remember what time Colin arrived, but he thinks that it was sometime around like 10:45, maybe 11. Some of the girls who were there with Brian Jr. earlier in the evening left not long after that. Colin said that everyone was hanging out, listening to music, having a couple drinks. He knew some of Brian Jr.'s friends, but wasn't really close to them since they were older than he was. Allie McCabe, Jen and Matt's daughter, had been home earlier that night for a hockey team dinner at her house. Then she went to her sister's basketball game at the high school sometime around 6:30. This is the same game that her parents were at that night, though Allie drove separately. After the game, she went riding around with a few of her friends, and she tells the jury a story about finding a dog and taking it to the police station thinking that it was lost. And then while she was at the police station, the owner of the dog called the police looking for the dog, so then they took the dog back. She said after that, she drove her two friends home and then went to another friend's house. While there, Colin Albert texted Allie from Brian Jr.'s house asking for a ride home. Allie said that she left her friend's house to go pick him up, and when she arrived, she texted him that she was there. She saw lights on in the house, but that's all she really noticed, and she said that he came out within a few minutes. Caitlin Albert said that when they arrived home from the waterfall, they parked in the driveway and walked inside, and she remembers seeing Colin in the foyer area when she came in, but said that he wasn't there long. She said that Higgins was the next to come inside, but Caitlin didn't notice what he drove or where he parked. It had started to snow, nothing crazy, and Allie McCabe said that she drove Colin home, saw him go inside sometime right before 12:30, and then she went home. Now, I want to get into this a little bit right here because there's a few things that happened in trial while talking about all of this. Lally asked Allie about an interview that she had with troopers in August of 2023. Apparently, she talked to them on a Zoom call, and she said that she provided the text that she sent Colin to let him know that she was there from that night with a timestamp. But here's the problem. By the time they finally got around to talking to Allie this many months later, she had upgraded her phone and the texts are apparently not available anymore, so all he had to enter into evidence is a screenshot that was taken with her phone. The texts weren't actually texts, though. They were iMessages, and iMessages are sent through either Wi-Fi or data on the phone, not through the cellular service, which means you can't really verify them through a cell provider or a phone bill, for example. iMessages will show up as data usage, but they won't have individual time-stamped entries on your bill. You can verify them with a forensic download of a phone, but of course, they didn't do that with Allie. So they didn't even ask to look at her phone or see the text, so all they have is this screenshot. The reason that this can present a problem for the jury is that screenshots are really easy to manipulate with times and contacts, and you can easily delete messages before you take the screenshot. Now, that does not mean that the jury is going to assume that she did that, but the jury is going to know that it's possible. When the defense's theory seemingly involves Colin Albert being at 34 Fairview for longer than what they testified to, it's something that the defense will poke holes in to keep the jury seeing reasonable doubt. The judge instructs the jury that in order to consider any electronic communication in their deliberations, they basically have to believe that it's more likely than not that these texts are what they look like between Colin and Allie and that they're accurate. The texts are displayed for the jury, and we see text from Colin at 11:54 that said, "You can get me now if easier." Allie responds at 11:55, "Okay, I'm driving people home now." And Colin then tells her, "Just get him after." Now, I have questions about this because I feel like it's kind of unclear. Lally had asked Allie McCabe earlier where she was when she got the text from Colin, and she said that she had already driven her friends home, and she was at another friend's house when she got this text.
And do you recall where you were or sort of who you were with when you first get that text or communication from Colin to pick him up?
Yes, I was at another friend's house. After I drove Avery and Danielle home, I went somewhere else.
You drove the two friends that you were with earlier home, and then you went somewhere else?
Yes, I believe, yes.
Is that point did you get a text from Colin?
Yes.
So it's not very clear here if she was at her friend's house like she testified to or if she was driving people home like she said in her text. It was never made clear and nobody questioned it, so not really sure. During cross-examination, Yannetti mentions the police not doing an extraction of Allie's phone or ever looking at Allie's phone before she got rid of it when she upgraded. Allie said at that point there was no reason for them to. This is presumably because the theory that Colin could have been there or been involved didn't come out until after that. Yannetti also brings up the Life 360 app during cross-examination and lists off some times from that night. Allie said that she went home after dropping Colin off and she arrived home about 12:30. Her Life 360 app apparently showed multiple drives that night, which makes sense since we know that she was taking people home. But some of these timestamps are after 12:30, including driving through the Canton High School bubble, which is on Washington Street, and one of the routes that she may take from Fairview to Colin's house, for example. So if Allie had left later to pick up Colin and then drove through there and the Life 360 app picked her up at Canton High School when she was taking Colin home, and then she arrived at 1:32 a.m. instead of 12:32 a.m., Allie said that she doesn't remember going anywhere else that night, though, and we haven't heard from any of the data experts yet on any of this information, so we don't know about the accuracy or the timestamps or anything like that. So anything on this right now would be just pure speculation. I'm sure that we'll hear more about it in the future, though. Brian Jr. also remembered Colin leaving around the same time that his parents and sister arrived home. He remembers his mom cleaning when she came in, and his uncle Matt and Aunt Jen McCabe arrived after that. He said that he never saw anyone else enter the house. After arriving home, Brian Albert went upstairs to get Chloe and let her outside, and then she hung around in the kitchen for a few minutes before going back upstairs into their room. At some point, Julie Nagel texted her brother Ryan to come get her. Ryan was out with his girlfriend at the time named Heather and his friend Ricky. Ryan went from CF McCarthy's to Hillside and estimated that he had somewhere between 5 to 8 beers, but he wasn't driving. His friend Ricky D'Antano was. Ryan said that they left Hillside around midnight and went to go pick up his sister from Brian Jr.'s house. Ryan was in the passenger seat and Ricky was driving and Heather was sitting in the back of the crew cab F-150. As they approached Fairview Road to take a left, there was a car coming from the opposite direction about to turn right onto Fairview. Ricky doesn't remember this car, but Ryan said that he remembered, and he said that Ricky flashed his lights to signal for the SUV to turn first. For that brief moment while they were facing each other, Heather said that she was able to see a female driving the SUV and a male with short hair in the passenger seat. She didn't mention a hat. They pulled up to the same house, and the SUV stopped just ahead of them. Now, this is where a lot of the memories tend to vary. All three in the truck remembered parking in front of the driveway. Heather Maxson remembers the SUV stopping probably a little past the mailbox, just what she said was 2 or 3 feet between them. Ricky D'Antano remembers the SUV parked maybe 10 to 20 yards in front of him and points in the photo to the middle of the yard. Ryan Nagel remembers the SUV being a car length or maybe a car length and a half in front of them. Julie said that she remembers seeing the SUV pull up prior to her brother being there, and once at the mailbox, and then in the middle of the yard, and then closer to the flagpole. But Julie said that when she walked out to talk to her brother at the truck, that the SUV was gone. It wasn't there anymore. So all different versions of this. Now, Heather, in the backseat of the truck, said that the SUV never moved while they were sitting there. And Ricky, the driver, did not recall seeing it move either. But Ryan, who was in the passenger seat, said that he noticed the SUV moved up maybe another car length ahead of them at the same time that his sister Julie came out of the door of the house. Ryan believes that his sister came out the side door by the garage, but Julie said that she came out the front door. Ryan could tell that his sister had been drinking and said that she talked to the three of them, decided that she wasn't going to leave, and then went back to the house. Heather, Ricky, and Julie all remember the window being rolled down for her to talk to them, but Ryan remembered opening the passenger door, not the window, because he said that he thought that she was going to be getting in the truck. The time estimates all vary, but most are about 5 minutes or less that Julie is out there. Now, when they left, Heather said that the SUV was still in the same position. It was running, the taillights were on. Ricky and Ryan remembered the taillights on as well. When they drove by, Heather and Ryan could both tell that the interior light was on and there was a female in the driver's seat, but neither of them saw anyone else in the car. Ricky said that he didn't look, so he doesn't know. Nobody in Ricky's truck saw damage to the SUV or to the taillights, and nobody in Ricky's truck saw a Jeep with a snowplow, especially not a Jeep with a snowplow parked in between them and the SUV in front of them. Brian Jr. said that he looked out the window and he saw the dark SUV facing south towards Cedar Crest with the passenger door facing the house. Brian Jr. said that when he looked out a few times, the first time he saw the SUV, it was by the mailbox, and the second time by the flagpole. To be clear, I am comparing all of these to show the different stories that the jury is hearing. Witness testimony is incredibly unreliable, especially when it involves alcohol, and the more time passes, the worse it gets. These conflicting stories don't mean that anyone is lying, it's just showing how malleable memory can be. Also, it probably would have been a lot better if they had been interviewed right after this happened, but that didn't happen either. Sarah Levinson wasn't interviewed for 9 months. Ryan Nagel was interviewed by Massachusetts State Police on February 7th of 2022, and he told state troopers that Heather and Ricky were in the truck with him, but they didn't bother talking to Heather or Ricky until after the federal investigation had already started. That's crazy. Heather Maxson wasn't interviewed until 19 months later. Ricky D'Antono was not interviewed until 16 months later. And not by state police, these are by federal investigators. The state police didn't even interview him until 5 months after that. When Alan Jackson is questioning Ryan Nagel about this, Ryan mentions the feds, which is the first that the jury has heard about a federal investigation.
When it refresh your recollection, do you remember talking in May of 2023 with anybody about this case?
I don't know, 2023 may have been the feds.
Okay, let's...
I'm trying to...
Just listen to my question.
No, I understand.
Were you talked to by anybody? Don't say who. Just tell me if you were talking... Yes or no?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay.
The judge has ruled that the jury isn't allowed to hear about there being a federal investigation, but they are allowed to discuss anything that has come from the federal investigation. Up to this point, they have navigated this by saying things like, at the grand jury that wasn't involving the state, or at the grand jury that neither myself or Mr. Lally was present for. But of course, Ryan Nagel isn't going to know that, so he said it just kind of simply without knowing, and they kept it moving. The defense did point out the other witnesses and when they were interviewed, highlighting the lack of investigation that occurred. Brian Albert Jr. wasn't interviewed until 18 months later. Caitlin Albert, 16 months later, by the feds, not the state police. Tristan Morris was not even interviewed until 1 week before his testimony in this trial. 1 week. And all of these people are witnesses who were right there around the time of when they say John O'Keefe died. It's mind-blowing. So let's move into leaving the house. Julie Nagel and Sarah Levinson got a ride home from the McCabes, and when they were pulling out, Jen turned around and they were making jokes about making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches because I guess there was a loaf of bread and some peanut butter and jelly in the car. When they're leaving, Julie Nagel, who wasn't interviewed until later that year, gave a statement that she saw some type of dark object on the ground in the yard by the fire hydrant. Here's Julie Nagel describing what she says she remembers.
I did notice behind Sarah and Jen, I did notice something out of the ordinary, like a black blob in the ground by the flagpole.
And from where you were situated in the car, do you know sort of what was the lighting like over in that area of the yard that you saw by the flagpole?
It was pretty dark out, but the snow was kind of heavy at that point, so... couldn't really see too much, but...
So the snow's coming down at that point?
Yes.
And if you know about where in relation to the flagpole was this black object that you saw?
I would probably say, close to, the street, but, in their lawn, right kind of in front of the flagpole next to it. I did say out loud, I was like, I think I might have saw something. I'm not kind of sure what it was, but I was also... intoxicated drinking, so didn't really know what I saw. But Sarah was like, "What, Julie?" And I was like, "I don't know what it was." And then that was kind of really it.
And that was sort of the end of the conversation in reference to that. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes.
Can you describe how big an object it was that you saw?
I'd probably say 5 or 6 feet. Long, but...
And at the time that you're driving by at that point, could you tell what it was?
Not quite sure, no.
And here's defense attorney David Yannetti questioning her about this.
You claim now to have seen a black object in the snow, correct?
Yes.
Object is the term that you used when you were finally interviewed about this matter, correct?
A black object, yes.
Right. You never before ever told any investigator that what you actually saw was a black blob, correct?
I don't remember.
And you also never, ever told any investigator that this black object that you described was actually 5 feet or 6 feet long, correct?
Correct, yes.
The very first time you're now mentioning this testimony that this black object, as you describe it, was actually 5 or 6 feet long was just today, after 12 noon on May 14th of 2024, correct?
Lally asked me how big it was, so I just told him right now, yeah.
Yeah, Lally, when you say Lally, you mean Mr. Lally,
correct? Yes, Mr. Lally, correct, yes.
Mr. Lally just asked you during this trial, again,
yeah,
right before this jury.
Yannetti brings up that Julie Nagel never contacted police or Brian Jr., Brian Sr., who's a trained first responder, or anyone else seeing this dark object or black blob, even after learning that John O'Keefe was found in the yard that morning. So here's where the jury's personal thoughts will come into play. Julie Nagel is the only one to say that she saw anything that night, but she also testified that the SUV was gone when she was outside talking to her brother. So if she was intoxicated enough not to see a whole car right by where they were, then can they rely on her testimony about seeing a black blob? And if she saw that, then why would she not have told anyone after finding out that John O'Keefe was found there the next day? Also, Matt and Jen McCabe both testified that they didn't hear Julie Nagel say this in the car. And Jen said that she was physically turned around in the car facing the back seat talking to the girls. So these are questions that the jury will have to consider when determining how much weight to give each part of the testimony. Yannetti also brings up that Jen McCabe asked Julie Nagel for a screenshot of the text between her and her brother from that night. She sent them to Jen, but she said that she didn't think any actual investigator had ever asked her for those texts or screenshots, just Jen McCabe. The cross-examination ends for the day with Yannetti asking about the timing of Julie Nagel's statement to Trooper Proctor. Almost everyone who left the house that night, Jen McCabe, Matt McCabe, Brian Higgins, Sarah Levinson, Caitlin Albert, Tristan Morris, Ryan Nagel, Heather Maxson, and Ricky Dantano, all of these people passed by the spot where Officer John O'Keefe was found, and nobody saw him or anything else lying in the yard. Yannetti wants to point this out, so he begins to say that as of October 22nd, the defense had publicly announced that nobody in that house had seen a body in the yard. And then within days of that, she's now the first person to say that she saw some type of object.
And you know, Ms. Nagel, that as of October of 2022, the defense had, in this case, had publicly announced that
objection, Your Honor.
Had saw right. Body on that
so that question's improper. I'm going to strike that question.
Lally objected, the judge sustained, and struck the question from the record. We'll be right back. Caitlin said that she was the last to leave, and Tristan came to pick her up in her Jeep Cherokee. She said that her plan was always for Tristan to go home early from Waterfall and get some sleep since he had to plow early the next morning, but he still came back to Canton to pick her up. On cross-examination, Yannetti pushes back on this a little bit and asks about Tristan waking up to make a 20-minute drive, 40 minutes round trip, to come pick her up on top of the 40-minute round trip that he already made to Waterfall and back for dinner. Yannetti asked Caitlin why it was so important for her to leave that night so late, and Caitlin says that she didn't want to get snowed in there. Yannetti asks her if she took Chloe with her when she left, and Caitlin said no. She came out the front door when Tristan arrived and walked to the car, and they drove right by where John would have been, but didn't see anything. Caitlin said that she was wearing high-heel boots, so she was looking down when she was walking because of the snow, and she said that she wasn't looking out the window when she left. Tristan did take the stand, but he didn't remember much of anything. He didn't remember how long he was at Waterfall, doesn't remember if it was snowing when he left, doesn't remember what time Caitlin called or texted him, or what time he went to pick her up, or how much snow was falling when he did, or where he parked, or what door she came out of, or much of anything else other than she sat in the passenger seat. When asked why he drove all the way out there to pick Caitlin up at that time, he had a very understandable response.
From your discussions with Caitlin, what was the reason that you went back to 34 Fairview to pick her up and bring her home?
Objection.
We'll allow it. Why'd you do that?
Well, she's high maintenance. I didn't really want to have to deal with her.
She wanted to come home, is that correct?
Yes.
Smart man. The next day, Brian Jr.'s bedroom is upstairs toward the back of the house, so he didn't wake up to any of the screaming or anything going on outside of the house at Fairview that morning. He said that he woke up around 7:30 or 8 when his dad knocked on the door. He got dressed, went downstairs where Jen and Matt McCabe were with his mom and dad. He said that he stayed down there for about 15 minutes and then went back up to his room for what he estimated to be probably an hour or two. And then when he came back downstairs, it was just his parents there. So other than some discrepancies here and there and changing memories, it's all the same basic story. And one thing that remains consistent is that nobody saw John O'Keefe enter the house and nobody saw John O'Keefe in the yard. Another thing that everyone has said is that Colin Albert left 34 Fairview around the same time that the Alberts were getting back from the waterfall. They didn't really see him leave or see Allie's car there to pick him up, but they all said that he mentioned leaving and they didn't see him after that. The alleged issues between Colin Albert and John O'Keefe have been at the center of the defense's theory and the subject of multiple motions and hearings that have been filed. He has some questionable social media posts that have been shared over the course of the past year, and there's been a lot of speculation about his hot-headed temper being the potential catalyst for a drunken fight gone wrong. When Colin was called to the stand, he came out kind of unrecognizable from the version that we've seen in his pictures and videos. I included his testimony from direct examination in the compilation that I did with all of the testimony during the first half of this episode, but I wanted to get into his cross-examination as well so that you have an idea of what the jury will be deliberating on. Alan Jackson led the cross and for almost 2 hours walked the jury through all of the questions that he's been wanting to ask. There were some questions that Colin seemed kind of evasive for, and it's hard to tell if it's typical 20-year-old male defiance or personal feelings toward the defense team or maybe nerves, but whatever reason it was, there were some questions that he didn't really seem like he wanted to answer. For example, even the last time that he talked to Allie McCabe, who is his best friend, he said so often that he didn't remember that Alan Jackson even asked him if he was instructed to say, "I don't remember," for any and all of the questions that made him nervous or got him stumped. Jackson asked Colin how he can have such terrible memory from all the questions that he's asking him, but can still remember that he left 34 Fairview at 12:10 a.m. 2.5 years ago. Colin said that he didn't prepare for his testimony with anyone, but then he said that he was prepped with Lally about a month ago, and Lally was telling him the questions that he would be asked here. But Colin couldn't remember what those questions were, and he couldn't remember what his answers would be. Jackson asked if they gave him any instructions on how to answer questions, or how to dress, or anything like that, and Colin said no. Jackson also asked Colin about whether or not he's been following this case on the news or social media. Colin said that he doesn't have social media. We know that he had it before, and there's a post that's circulating from over the weekend that appears to be from him, so he may have it again, but At the time of this testimony, he said he doesn't have it. And he said he knows nothing about the media coverage in this case. The topic of the Proctors is brought up, and the photos from Courtney Proctor's wedding are shown to the jury, where Colin was a ring bearer and is featured in the pictures with Michael Proctor, the lead investigator on this case. He's been to the Proctor home multiple times and confirmed that he's known Proctor since he was a kid and that their families are close. Jackson asked Colin about his interviews with police, and the jury hears that Colin wasn't interviewed by state police until July of last year, a year and a half after John's death. Proctor conducted the interview, and it only lasted for about 10 minutes. They didn't take his phone or even ask to look at it, and the interview was friendly and comfortable. Jackson asked Colin why there are no texts showing with Allie for a month after the text to pick him up, since they're best friends, and Colin says that it's because sometimes they switch to Snapchat. Jackson asked him if the reason that they switch to Snapchat is because he knows that those get deleted. He acknowledges knowing about that setting, but doesn't say anything about that being the reason that he swapped over to Snapchat. Jackson then asked Colin about providing the text to police.
But in September of 2023, Michael Proctor's partner, a man by the name of Yuri Buchnik, you know that name?
Yeah.
He contacted you and said he wanted to talk about your text messages, correct?
I don't remember.
Do you remember that you told Yuri Buchnik when he asked about the text messages, you did not have the screenshot anymore. You sent it to your father, Chris.
I don't remember that.
Do you recall telling Yuri Buchnik if he wanted to get the screenshot, you weren't going to give it to him. He'd have to get it from your dad.
Do not remember that.
You remember Trooper Buchnik agreeing with you and saying, sure, I'll just call your dad and get it from him.
Don't remember that.
You don't remember giving, you certainly don't remember ever giving Trooper Buchnik a copy of that screenshot.
No, I don't remember.
Because you didn't, did you?
I do not remember.
But you did give it to your dad, right?
I do not remember.
Do you remember anything about this case?
Objection, Your Honor.
I'll withdraw it.
Some photos were entered into evidence through Allie McCabe that showed Colin with his family at a party on February 11th, 2022. This was to celebrate one of the Albert sons coming home from the Marines. This is a couple weeks after John's death, and the picture doesn't show Colin with any type of injuries or bloodied knuckles. The defense enters in a picture during cross-examination that was taken at Fenway Johnny's by the event staff and posted on social media on February 26th. Jackson says that the event staff took this picture, so there's no way to alter the metadata or the date, and he zooms in on Colin's right hand, where you can see his bloody knuckles. He asks Colin about this.
February 26th, less than a month after the incident at Fairview, that's what your right knuckles look like, correct?
Correct.
And this is a true and accurate depiction of your condition on or about February 26th. Correct?
Correct.
How'd you get those injuries, Robert?
I was at a party, a house party my senior year, and I remember it being icy out, and it was kind of like a steep hill of a driveway, and I was walking up the driveway, and I slipped down the driveway, and I tried to catch myself, but I had something in my left hand, so I had tried to brace myself with my right hand, and I ended up sliding a little bit down the driveway.
What'd you have in your left hand?
If I remember, it was either my phone or a beverage.
So, according to you, you fell on ice and injured your knuckles, as we just saw in that photograph, right across the top of your knuckles.
Correct.
So, you fell onto, what, pavement? Asphalt?
Yes.
And you braced yourself when you fell, your entire body weight, by putting your right hand down in a fist, and you injured your right fist, just the top of the knuckles on your right fist. When you fell down?
Correct.
Seriously?
Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained.
Colin said that he's never been in a fight before, other than with his brothers. The defense wants to enter some videos from social media into evidence, and before that can happen, the jury is sent out of the room so that the attorneys can ask Colin some questions. The videos can be played for the judge, and then she gets to decide if they come in or not and in what capacity. Now, I'm going to play both videos so that you can hear the audio, but warning, there's some colorful language here.
I will beat all your asses. I promise you, I will fuck you all up. Pull up, bitch.
And the second video. They're kind of hard to hear, but in the first one, Colin is sending a message to the Advantage Boys, which is apparently a hockey team that hung out with some of the girls in his group, and he didn't approve. Here's Alan Jackson questioning him about that.
You indicated on cross-examination you've never been in a fight.
No.
Indicating that you have no violent tendencies and no violent complaints, right?
Nope.
What were you saying on that video?
That I would beat them up.
Did you say you would beat them up, or did you say, I will fuck you up?
I said, I will F you up.
No, you didn't say, I will F you up. What did you actually say?
That I would fuck them up.
You also said something about beating somebody's ass, right?
Correct.
What did that mean?
That I would beat them up.
So when you said, I will fuck you up and I will beat your ass, was that a friendly invitation?
No.
It was a threat, correct?
I don't know if I would call it a threat.
Don't?
I'm not sure.
Someone walks up to you. I'm not going to do it. But if someone did, walked up to you and said, I will fuck you up. I will beat your ass. You wouldn't take that as a threat?
If they walked up to me, yeah.
Ah. But if they didn't walk up and just shouted it across the street and stood there and said, I will fuck you up, I will beat your ass, that's not a threat.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think you are sure, sir. Were you threatening these Advantage Boys guys, whoever they are?
Yeah, kinda.
Were you
kinda
threatening them with violence?
Kinda, yeah.
Yeah.
He also asks him about the other video.
In the second video, you said, fuck you a number of times, and then you said KO, you said pull up, KO, bang bang, right?
Correct.
Explain that to me.
Not sure, like, explain what I said.
Is that a threat?
Yeah.
Pull up, bitch, right?
Yeah.
Who are you talking to?
Those same Advantage kids.
Got it. So you're threatening him yet again, a second time.
Yeah.
What does pull up mean?
Like, come by?
Yeah, meaning get over here. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep.
Because when you do, I'm going to fuck you up, right?
Yeah.
Meaning I'm going to fight you and I'm going to put you down, correct?
Correct.
That was your threat to them.
Correct.
Jackson also brings up the fact that Colin showed up to another hearing with busted knuckles again, and the attorneys apparently even asked him about his fist at this hearing because he had knuckle injuries, quote, yet again, end quote. He said that he must have been hitting the bag, and it just didn't cause any injuries to his left hand for whatever reason. Colin said that he never fought the guys that he was addressing in the videos or met them face to face. Jackson argues for these coming into the jury to see because he says that they're highly relevant given that Colin said before that he had never been in a fight and didn't have any violent tendencies. He said Lally pointed out the photo that was entered through Allie from February and pointed out that Colin didn't have anything on his knuckles in that picture. So Jackson says that he should be able to show the jury this as well. He argues that it goes toward the Bowden defense because the police should have investigated this further, and that it also goes toward the third-party culprit defense. Lally denies opening this door and calls this rank speculation, says that it has no relevance, and it diverts attention of the jury. Jackson argues that Lally said that there's no evidence of a fight, but John's injuries look like he was beaten to death, not hit by a car, and he says the Commonwealth doesn't get to dictate the state of the facts. After this intense argument, the videos are allowed in, and the jury is shown both videos. Colin admits to these being threats, but he stands by his testimony that he had never been in a fight with anyone but his brothers. We'll be right back. There was one small break in the nonstop parade of Canton residents and Alberts to hear from an expert. Terry Kuhn from UC Davis Vet Forensics came in to testify about the testing of swabs done on John's clothing to let us know about the canine DNA. Spoiler alert, there's no dog DNA on the swabs. So that shuts down the dog theory, right? No, not really. Remember the argument that just because there's no human DNA detected on that hair, that doesn't mean it's not there? Well, the same argument applies here, and is actually a little bit of a stronger argument in this case, for a few reasons. Let's start from the beginning and walk through this because it's going to be very important for the defense's case. One major factor that the defense points out is that the analyst is testing the canine DNA on the swabs. They were not actually sent clothing or a cut sample from the clothing. The testing was limited to just two swabs that they were sent. Jackson also asked Ms. Kuhn about the proper techniques to swab the source material and preventing contamination before the samples are sent to her, but she wasn't sent any information about that, so she can't testify to it being done properly. She does say, however, that if something has been packaged incorrectly, it can cause mold growth, which eats away at DNA, preventing her from being able to see it. Jackson says that there are no markings that indicate where the swabs were taken from, which also creates a problem. Ms. Kuhn also explains that dirt and blood can both be inhibitors, as well as garment dye. Inhibitors basically stop the PCR process from happening, which prevents them from seeing results. So here's the big part of all of this. The report says that while they didn't detect canine DNA, they did detect the presence of inhibitors, and this happens when either the canine DNA is degraded or the DNA is obscured by inhibition because of these inhibitors that were present, or there's no canine nuclear DNA present in that sample. So Jackson points out that two out of three of those explanations for the result that they got actually allow for the possibility of canine DNA to have been present, but just not able to be seen. So it may have been there, but the test didn't pick it up. Is this enough to keep reasonable doubt for the jury? So far, it seems like it. I've mentioned before, the level of intensity of the followers of this case is like nothing I've ever seen. The social media platforms are all full of animosity and polarized debates, some which far surpass any healthy boundaries of any kind of passionate discussion. I've personally experienced a lot of hate and vitriol on social media for questioning things and pointing out inconsistencies with both theories. As exhausting as it can be, I know that it unfortunately comes with the territory because of this career. This is a wild case. It's incredibly interesting. There are so many twists and turns and questions that you can't help but to want to watch along, guessing and wondering and hoping for answers as the justice system plays out in front of us. In most trials, the defendant begins with the presumption of innocence, and we watch as the prosecution lays out evidence to prove that they got the right guy or girl. In many cases, it's rewarding to see the justice system in action, seeing the bad guys put behind bars, helping to keep us and our families safe. This case is different, though. There are two very different theories of what happened, and each theory points the finger at someone different. That means that no matter what the truth is, someone is getting blamed for a horrific crime that they did not commit. I've been really tough on the investigation in this case, and for good reason. It's a mess. And I know that I've said this before, but all parties in both theories are innocent unless they're proven guilty. But somewhere along the way, that presumption of innocence has dissolved in the toxicity of the online world. It has gone beyond discussions about what evidence or statements or even witness reliability. It has turned into outright harassment, which is never okay. I mentioned before that both the prosecution and the defense filed motions to exclude testimony about the witness intimidation charges that were filed against Aidan Carney. Although both sides wanted to keep that out, Judge Cannone said that she's not going to tie the witness's hands if witness intimidation or harassment comes up naturally in their answers. And it just so happens, it did. Brian Albert Jr. was being asked a question in his cross-examination about how many times he's talked to his family about the ongoing case. His answer gave the jury the first introduction to some of the problems that they've faced related to this trial.
How many times did you discuss this case with members of your family before you spoke to the Massachusetts State Police on May 18, 2023?
I don't have an answer for that. I don't know. How many times?
Hundreds.
We talk about it pretty decent, I mean, considering, yeah.
What members of your family have you discussed this case with?
My parents, my sister, occasionally my aunt, JJ, and Uncle Matt.
Hundreds of conversations.
You'd have to split it up and quantify what conversations were about the actual case and what conversations have been the harassment we faced since then.
Jen McCabe was angry as she brought it up as well when she was asked about talking to Chris and Julie Albert about the case.
Do I speak to Chris and Julie Albert?
Have you spoken to them about these events between then and now?
About this case? Is that what you're asking?
Yes, Ms. McCabe, I'm asking about this case.
Of course I speak to them all the time about the vicious harassment we are all receiving.
Okay, but that wasn't my question. My question was, did you talk to them about this case, Ms. McCabe?
Colin Albert brings it up as well.
Obviously, you've been thinking about this case quite a bit, haven't you?
Yeah.
Over the last 2.5 years?
No.
How long have you been thinking about this case?
Since people started writing about me on the internet.
You were at a house where an individual ended up dead on the lawn the next morning. Did that prompt you to start thinking about this case?
No.
Not so much, huh?
Nope.
During redirect, Lally asks him to explain that.
And you had indicated in your testimony in response to that questioning, essentially not until people were writing things about you on the internet, correct?
Correct.
Can you expound upon that? Can you explain to the jury sort of when that occurred and what were the things that were being written about you on the internet?
I'd say about a little over a year, it started when people on Twitter, Instagram, social media were just coming at my family, calling us murderers, harassing us, showing up to our doorsteps, our sports games. I mean, we couldn't leave the house without people taking pictures of us, and it's very terrible.
And how long has that gone on for?
The past year and change, a couple months. Past year and a couple months, I'd say.
And when 20-year-old Allie McCabe is asked during redirect examination why the police didn't ask her for her text about what time Colin had left before last year, she told Lally that it's because Colin wasn't in the house when John was there. So until that theory came out and people started harassing them about it, the police had no reason to question it. Lally asked her to expand on that, and the defense objected. Judge Cannone overruled the objection, saying that the door had been opened to allow this testimony in. Allie cried on the stand when she said what she's had to deal with.
Some questions about that time frame of August of 2023 when you were asked and you turned over sort of screenshots to troopers from the state police, correct?
Correct.
You were asked about previous times indicating that you weren't asked, and it wasn't relevant, correct?
Correct.
Now, you know why you were asked in August of 2023 versus any prior time period?
Because Colin Albert wasn't in the house, and then it was brought up here that he was.
And brought up where?
By the defense.
And around that time of August 2023?
I believe so, yes.
And with reference to relevancy, is that what you were talking about?
Correct.
And what, if anything else, are you close friends with Colin Albert, is that correct?
Correct.
What, if anything else, has your family or Colin Albert and his family undergone over the course of dependency of this case?
Objection.
No, the door's been opened. I'm allowing it.
Well, basically harassment.
Harassment by whom?
Bloggers, people online.
And what, if anything, in relation to Colin Albert being in the house has occurred as far as the harassment that you're talking about?
Can you rephrase?
With reference to what you were talking about as far as the relevancy of Colin Albert being in the house at that time, what, if any, harassment was there in relation to that and in relation to Colin?
Well,
no, go ahead. She can answer.
Colin wasn't at the house, so he's being harassed for... He was not at the house when John was there, so I drove him home. So the people are harassing him, saying he was at the house when it's not true.
When you speak about harassment, what specifically type of harassment are we
talking about? Phone call, constant phone calls, emails, awful messages.
Objection.
I'll allow it. Focus on this witness, not Colin Albert at this point.
As far as... you and your family, what, if any, type of harassment have you received?
People showing up at our house, people emailing my school. Just like a lot of harassment. Can I have a moment, please?
Sure.
I'm sorry. I have something. Thank you.
And how long a period of time has that persisted for?
Very long time.
Thank you. I have no further.
I've said it before, but it bears repeating. All parties in this case have the presumption of innocence. It is a public trial, which means that we're going to look at things and analyze it, weighing evidence to see what fits and what doesn't. But involvement in the case should stop there. Harassment and personal attacks should not be happening. At the time of this recording, Jen McCabe is still not done with cross-examination, and it's been a fiery one so far. I brought up some of what she said and what her husband Matt have said in this episode, but the majority of it I'm saving for the next episode so that we can look at it all together once the testimony is over. There are some things that they have brought up that are very different than what we've heard from others, and I want to take a look at it all together. The prosecution is only halfway through their witnesses. We still have a long way to go, and we still have a lot of questions that need to be answered. My name is Brandy Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.